laughed a little, and she laughed back some. "Come on, let's warm you up," I said, and I opened the passenger side front door. I turned the heat all the way up, and we sat there, bundled in our coats, waiting for the air to warm. "When you said, 'Let's warm you up,' I thought you were going to open the back door," she said. "That felt too... something."
"I get it."
"Yeah. Plus, I can warm you up here, too." I reached over and took her gloved hand in mine and squeezed. She squeezed back. "What made you cry so much in the movie?" Hannah didn't say anything for a bit.
"You're a different sort of guy," she finally said.
The word magenta entered my head. Ever since Rafe had given me that word 5 nights ago, it was kind of hard not to think about it. "Am I?"
"You are. You actually want to know who I am, for one."
"Is that so weird? In the world of creepy Natick boys, in my limited experience, yes." I laughed. "Sorry to hear that."
"Well, there's something to be said for purely physical, but I like that you ask questions."
"Cool.
So to answer, are you sure you want to hear this?"
"I really do," I said.
"One summer, when I was about 9, we spent the whole time in Truro. It's on the Cape. It was a great summer. We would go to the beach during the days, and my dad and I would do this thing we called walk and talk, which I guess isn't that unusual, but for me it was. I'd never had alone time with my dad, and we talked about everything. This was pre-Marnie bullshit, of course. We'd walk hand in hand, and he'd tell me about all the different kinds of birds we'd see, and we'd look for perfectly smooth rocks, and I'd tell him all about what happened last year in school with my best friend at the time, Lacey Walker, who was the first girl to get breasts and her period. Not that it matters in this story. Every day, Dad would stand up next to the blanket while we three were lying there, me and my mom and him, and he'd say, 'Walk and talk?' And I'd jump up and grab his hand and we'd go. That's about the happiest memory I have, those lazy, long days on the beach with my dad. And then the end of the summer came and his vacation ended. I guess he took August off, maybe? And I pleaded with him not to go because I wanted more, you know? More time with him, because all he did slash does is work. Like 80 hours a week, sometimes more. And I remember crying and screaming, 'Dad, don't go! Dad, don't go!' And he shook his head and got in his car and drove away. And I remember screaming my head off. And my mom, I think it hurt her feelings because she just went into the kitchen and clammed up. And I remember sitting on this picnic table on the beach, which was like 50 feet from the house, and just sitting there for hours, looking at the ocean and wondering what it would be like to have a father who was around more. I guess that's first world problems, eh?
I turned toward her. Aren't you the one who said boo to me when I said my problems didn't amount to much because they were small compared to other problems? She fought off a grin.
Nailed, she said. Nicely done. It's just, it makes me feel bad to whine to you about my summer-long beach vacation.
We went to the Cape once.
Yeah?
Yeah. We stayed at a motel. I was 8 and my brother was 5. We were supposed to stay 3 days, but on day 2 my dad got antsy and said we should go back and check on the farm. It was the first time we ever put our toes in a swimming pool, and we actually sang Peter, Paul, and Mary songs in the car on the way home. Mom did. Dad's not a singer. She laughed.
I have no idea who Peter, Paul, and Mary are.
I love that memory.
That's what's amazing about you. Do you know about vulnerability?
I automatically crossed my arms over my chest. What?
I've been doing some reading. This woman talks about vulnerability, and she says that it's basically the key to everything. Vulnerability is allowing people to see you exactly as you are, which is really hard because when you're vulnerable, you can get hurt. Most people armor up with bravado or something, but those people are missing out because without allowing yourself to be vulnerable, it's tough to have, like, any emotional experience at all. Letting people in is really vulnerable, and most people, especially introverts, have trouble. But you just let me in.
I didn't know what to say. What she was saying felt a little weird and new agey to me, but I didn't want to hurt her feelings.
Guys especially struggle with it. You're all taught that men don't show weakness. But the thing is, this woman says, vulnerability is not a choice. Either you do vulnerability, or it does you.
It does you?
Yeah. Like, you hold in all your feelings, and then you drink, or you do drugs, or whatever it is, instead of feeling stuff.
I thought about that. It was like how I'd gone directly to my plastic screwdriver when I was feeling pissed at Rafe. Was that what she meant? I really couldn't ask.
Interesting, I said.
She laughed.
You're just saying that.
I wasn't sure, actually. It was kind of interesting, and it kind of made me want to run away and drink orange Gatorade and vodka.
Instead, I leaned in and kissed her gently on the lips, and she put her arms around me and pulled me toward her, and my stomach wrenched up against the middle console. But I didn't mind, because being pulled toward Hannah was a feeling I wanted to, needed to have more of, immediately.
Chapter 16. I read the sentence 4 straight times. Instead of moving horizontally and vertically from the origin to get to the point in two-dimensional space, we could instead go straight out of the origin until we hit that point and then determine the angle this line makes with the positive x-axis. My eyes went over it again and again. Shit. Why was this stuff so boring to me? And why was it just slightly beyond my grasp? I'd diligently taken notes. I'd studied those notes. I had tried with varying levels of success to memorize formulas without understanding what they really meant. We'd have our first calc test in the morning, and I felt totally unprepared. Earlier that day, I'd gone to Ms. Dyson after class. She'd given back our pop quiz from the week before. I'd gotten an 83, and I asked her if other students were having the same problems with the subject or if it was just me.
It's all in your mind,
she said, arranging homework in a pile and putting the papers in her briefcase.
You did well, didn't you?
Yeah, but the night before I was up till 3 studying. She clicked her briefcase closed.
That's what high school is about. You study hard. You'll need to get used to it for college. There you study harder.
It's not the studying hard that I'm concerned about. It's my lack of understanding. I feel like the beginning of calculus made logical sense to me, but ever since we moved into 3 variables and some of the other stuff, it's been like nothing I've ever seen before. Maybe I should just transfer into an easier math class. She looked up at me as if she was annoyed with me.
Ben, aren't you the Pompous Award winner?
Yeah, but
I think you should push harder. Students who are far less talented than you get through this class. You don't want to have a lesser math class on your transcript. It won't read well to the top colleges. Maybe you're not applying yourself fully.
Maybe, I said. I didn't want to whine about it, but I wasn't sure it was supposed to be this hard. When I didn't walk away, she closed the book in front of her.
Look, why don't you try the math lab? Get a tutor. A lot of students use tutors. If you want to work something out, I do some tutoring.
I looked down at her desk and sucked in my lips. Carver's didn't need extra help. It just wasn't done, and we couldn't afford tutoring. I knew if I asked my dad, he'd tell me to buck up and work harder.
Just put everything away this evening, take out your book, and start from the beginning. It makes sense, Ben. You just have to see where you lost your way and build from there. It's not beyond you. I promise.
I hadn't thought of that. I wasn't going to let laziness get the best of me. If my award and scholarship counted on it, I'd prevail. Thanks, I said. I can do that. She smiled at me, and as I left, I imagined that Let's Get Ready to Rumble song playing, and a montage of me successfully kicking Calculus's butt. I laughed. It would not make for scintillating viewing. Now it was night, and I sat and read and reread the text until my eyes blurred. Finally, I slammed the book shut and went into the hallway looking for a break. I knocked on Rafe's door. Albie opened it. He was wearing pajama bottoms with various tropical fruits on them. I wasn't sure if this was some ironic hipster thing or not.
Benjamin,
he said, staring at the ground. Rafe wasn't there. Hey, I said, also staring down. We had really never spent time alone together before. I was pretty sure that even if he liked me, he considered me a jock, and Albie didn't trust jocks. Where's Rafe?
Study group? Philosophy?
Ah. What are you, up to?
Oh, studying hard.
I looked at his desk. On it, next to his police scanner, was what appeared to be a bunch of matchbox cars. Sure, I said. I looked over at him, and I could tell he'd seen me see the cars, but something told me not to push the matter. We just stood there, and I was trying to figure out a non-awkward exit strategy when he said,
Okay, maybe I'm not studying. You're going to make fun of me. I won't, Albie, I promise.
He stepped aside, and the floor behind him was littered with pieces of notebook paper that had drawings on them.
I'm making a town, he said.
Oh, I said, rubbing my bottom lip.
It's this thing I've done, like, all my life. I create a town, and then these cars,
he points at his desk,
these cars are like the people, I guess.
I walked inside. Huh, I said. One of the pieces of paper said, Rosita's Fruit Stand, and on it was a crude pencil drawing of a table with lots of pieces of fruit on it.
You think I'm a dork?
We all have weird things. I was racking my brain for something similar about me, but beyond liking to go to World War II museums by myself, there wasn't that much to compare to this.
I guess, he said. I think I like creating the world, and then... Why am I telling you this?
I smiled at him.
Because we're friends, I hope.
He averted his eyes from mine, but I could sense that he was glad I'd said it.
I guess I like the stories that I make up about the people cars.
So the cars are people. Got it.
Yeah, it's weird, but I like to make up stories in my head, I guess.
I think that's cool, I said. He laughed.
Yes, Ben Carver, king of the baseball team, thinks my nerdy car town thing is cool.
Captain, I corrected. And, well, what kind of stories? He went over to his desk and picked up a purple car that looked like maybe an old Chevy with those exaggerated fins.
So, this is Martin. He's like me, I guess. He's a detective, and sometimes he'll just watch. He might see two car people at the bank, and then those cars speed off, and it's a robbery. He has to, like, figure out who did it.
Have you ever written these stories down? He shook his head. You should. He seemed to contemplate this.
Maybe I will.
Cool. I'm just looking for a study break, have this horrible calc test coming, and I'm not ready.
You?
He said.
You're always ready for everything.
I rolled my eyes. Not exactly.
Do you know about the keys?
The keys?
Shit. Well, you're not a narc, right?
No, not a narc.
Tommy Mendenhall has all the answer keys to quizzes and tests in most courses. Not Mr. Bisbee in earth science. He changes things up. Also Ms. Patrick in history, I hear.
Oh, I said, folding my arms in front of my chest. I'd heard about this. It was a tradition at Natick. Every year, a senior inherited the answer keys that had been assembled by students over the years. It had never meant much to me. If other people wanted to cheat,
it was none of my business.
Albie studied me.
You're cool with it, right?
Yeah, I said. Not my thing, but I don't care. Even if I wanted to cheat, I wasn't sure how a person would do it in calculus. Ms. Dyson would probably ask us to show our work, so just knowing the correct multiple-choice answer would mean nothing.
You don't need the help, clearly, he said.
Actually, BC Calc is killing me. Literally, it's reaching around my neck and strangling me.
Ms. Dyson?
I nodded.
I'm pretty sure Ms. Dyson does the same tests and quizzes every year. Ask Tommy.
I shook my head.
Nah,
I said. Not for me.
Sure,
Albie said.
Well, my town beckons.
I saluted him and headed back to my room, my heart pounding in my chest. The cheating didn't sit right with me, but as usual, I was too much of a wimp to voice my opinion. Out in the hallway, I ran into Mendenhall.
Hey, I was hoping to catch you, he said.
Oh. I leaned against the wall, and he leaned in toward me in a way that made me want a buffer of about a foot, maybe two.
Listen, he said. I've been thinking about the whole captain thing. I think you're in over your head. You look back at the captains the last few years, and it's always someone outgoing who is the center of things. That's not you.
I crossed my arms over my chest.
I think you should try to be more social, maybe. You're too quiet. And the thing is, at the end of the day, this is my senior year. I want to win. And for us to do that, we need a captain who can do the job, get us united and fired up. You hear me?
I nodded. He laughed.
You really are reserved, aren't you?
Yes, I said. I don't say everything that comes to mind. And you should be glad I don't.
And that's cool. I mean, there are definitely good things about being the strong, silent type. You're not annoying, and that's good. And you're a good player. You could probably teach the others some stuff.
Thanks. He raised his chin like a king who had deigned to compliment a peasant.
The crap about no initiation stuff is dumb, in my opinion. If that's what you want, fine. But you still probably need me if you want to motivate the guys. You don't have their ear yet. What if I help you there?
Sure, I said. That would be good. He smiled.
You're a good guy, Carver. Let's try to make this work, okay?
Okay. Back in my room, I tried to shake off the feeling that I was about to get bulldozed by Mendenhall. I looked in the mirror and I focused on my arms. They were big and thick. I was no wilting flower, yet I just allowed him to talk down to me with no pushback. Would I stand up to him if he really tried to take my role away from me? One time I'd stood up for myself with the other athletes. It was during soccer in the fall. Some kids were making homophobic comments aimed at Rafe before he came out, and I shut that down in a hurry. It had felt good. Where was the line? How far would I be pushed before I pressed back? I sat down at my desk, opened my calculus book, and stared at the symbols. Every time I found my eyes glazing over, I powered through, reminding myself that I was a Pappus Award winner and a Carver, and doing poorly in BC Calculus wasn't an option for either role. I started pounding Gatorade around 2:30 so I could keep my eyes open, and at 5 a.m., when I finally figured out how to use the fundamental theorem to evaluate definite integrals, I collapsed in my bed, setting my alarm for 7 a.m. so that I wouldn't sleep through breakfast or my test. Lying there in a half coma, I wondered how I was going to keep this up. How many more sleepless nights would calculus cause me? I was pretty sure I'd do well on the test, but my nerves were shot.
Chapter 17. I drove home to Alton the final weekend in January because it was my mom's birthday. When I got there Friday night, my mom and dad welcomed me in their typical understated but loving way. Mom's first words were, "I made cookies," and then once I'd taken my jacket off, set my bag down, and taken one, she came over and gave me a big kiss. Dad said,
You look taller.
Luke was in our bedroom, lying on top of the comforter in gym shorts, despite the fact that it was below freezing out, and my dad doesn't believe in using heating oil. He was playing his Game Boy, per usual.
What up?
He said, and I could swear his voice had gotten lower in the 6 weeks I'd been away.
Yo, I responded. You missed Mom getting into trouble, he said.
I sat down on my bed and took off my boots.
What?
He looked up and turned off his game.
This hippy-dippy woman talked her into selling all sorts of crap at the store. Dad said no way, said the lady is banned from the store. Mom started crying.
What? I asked. In all my life, I'd never seen my mom cry. I'd never heard of it either. In the Carver family, tears are relegated to the something fell on me category.
It was wicked crazy, he said.
Did you talk to her? He shrugged.
And say what?
He had a point. Luke was probably not the most comforting person in the county. As I unpacked my bag, he updated me on some things.
I got people to stop calling her Bulldozer, he said,
and I remembered the girl he'd told me about when we went for our swimming lesson over winter break.
That's cool. Do you guys talk?
He shrugged and picked up his game again.
What was her name again?
Julie.
Oh, okay, I said. And I knew that was probably the end of the conversation. And it was. I pulled out a book and Luke kept playing his video game. No one spoke again until Luke said,
Good night, brother.
After I'd turned off the lights and I said back,
Good night.
I dreamt that Mendenhall was cornering me in my dad's barn and telling me how to do farm work. Even as I was in the dream, I realized that my father and Mendenhall had merged into one extremely judgmental person, and I wondered if I'd ever make either of them happy. The next morning, I woke to a sharp chill in my forearms, and I quickly pulled them under the flannel blanket to warm them up. I could hear the wind hissing and whipping through the bare trees outside. -10 at the most. Wind chill probably around -40. Luke was sleeping with two bare legs exposed on top of his down blanket, and I shook my head and smiled to myself. Doesn't matter if it's 50 degrees or 20 below, Luke's never chilly. I lay there in the comfort of my own warm cocoon thinking about hypothermia. I've read accounts of people trying to scale Mount Kilimanjaro where it's so cold at the top that their body temperature drops several degrees, and as it does so, a strange calm comes over them, like the total absence of heat is actually warm. In reality, it's their organs shutting down, but it doesn't feel like that. Bryce told me once that Tibetan monks practice a type of meditation that allows them to raise their core temperature. They do it by envisioning flames at the base of their spine. I wondered if I could do that, so I tried. It was tough to imagine the flames and not allow other thoughts to get in the way. Perhaps, I thought, Tibetan monks practice this and don't just try it once on a frigid New Hampshire day for 5 seconds, fail miserably, and then drop it. I watched out the window as my dad, in just a sweater and a hat, walked his lanky body over to the barn with our goat Becky following close behind. Cows don't care it's winter, and neither do I, he used to say. I swear there's some truth to the fact that heredity makes some people immune to cold, because nothing seems to chill my dad. He comes from generations of Czech farmers who don't bitch about the weather. They may talk about it endlessly, but they never complain. While Luke stayed in bed, I bundled up to go out to the barn. Farm work was not my forte, but I could help clean the barn stalls and spend some time with my dad. The morning air popsicled my teeth. I stuck my gloved hands deep into the pockets of my ratty old brown down jacket. Hey, I said, entering the barn, my breath a white mist that barely traveled 6 inches before freezing. My lungs ached.
Benny,
my dad said. He was on his knees in the stall with one of the cows, milking away. Clamp base, squeeze down, alternate hands.
I grabbed the pitchfork and shovel and went into another stall, where Becky lay on a bed of hay. The floor was littered with chicken shit, hay, and what looked like a half-eaten cantaloupe. The ceiling was just 6 feet high, so I had to bend over as I shoveled up the debris. The sharp smell of frozen manure assaulted my nostrils. There was an utter absence of sound on our farm in the winter. Because my dad didn't believe in using anything other than wood for heat, there was no buzz of electricity or hiss of oil or coal. I let the silence envelop us for a while, and I kept up my shoveling, feeling warmer by the second. And then it gets too quiet sometimes. "Cold today," I said when it got there for me, about 6 minutes, maybe seven.
"Yep," said Dad.
The cow he was milking moaned a bit. Silence again beyond the sound of milk squirting into the red bucket.
"You got warm enough clothes down there at school?"
"Yes, thanks." I swept the debris into a small pile, and we worked some more in silence. "It was actually pretty warm in Natick before I left," I said.
"How warm?" my dad said.
40s, maybe 45.
"You don't say," he said.
"Yep, it was pretty warm."
No more words. I stepped into the stall where my dad was, carefully navigating the frozen mud to sweep up some manure.
"Doing better with the schoolwork?" I said, and it wasn't like he didn't hear me. He just kept milking.
"I also met a girl," I added. He didn't say anything to that either, so I concentrated on sweeping, and we worked like that until the cows were milked and the barn was as clean as it was going to get. I loved my dad, but why did I even bother trying to squeeze conversation out of him? It was like squeezing warmth out of an ice cube. I'd come to a frozen barn to get warm. That never works. Even if you get so close to freezing that it feels warm, it's just a mirage. It's hypothermia, and then you die. While Dad sized up the job I did on the barn and did a little additional sweeping in Becky's stall, I walked toward our farm store, my eyes so dry I figured I might never be able to blink again. Inside, I was hit with the warm smell of chocolate and mint.
"Mmm," I said.
My mother was at the stove in the store's small kitchen area, pouring boiling water into a cup of cocoa. She smiled at me.
"Want one?"
"Happy birthday, and sure, that'd be perfect," I said. The store was connected to the front of our house, but it had a separate entrance for customers. Mom spent most of her time running the store, selling jams and produce, and during the summers when I wasn't in the fields with Dad, I'd help her too. Dad tended to count on me for tasks that used muscle, and Luke for things that involved farm skills. Mine were, as my dad loved to tease me, not exactly future farmers of America level. I sat on a stool next to Mom's. She reached over and put a gentle hand on my bicep and squeezed.
"You okay?"
I asked. She nodded.
"Sure."
Luke said something. She cringed.
"He shouldn't have done that. Don't matter."
"Mom," I said, "tell me, what happened?"
"Your father said his piece. Don't matter to get into it now."
"Who was this person? Come on, tell me." It wasn't like me to push her. Maybe it was things at school, the way I was beginning to realize that unlike my family, I liked conversation. Sometimes I could be in a humdrum mood and talk to Hannah on the phone, and when I was done, I'd feel like a different person. Or with Rafe, I'd buzz for hours after we talked, playing back different parts of the conversation. I didn't need constant talking like some people, but some, I was beginning to learn, I really liked. Mom took a deep breath.
"Her name is Hazel."
"Okay. Who is Hazel?" Mom's eyes lit up. Her eyes never did that.
"Unusual-looking woman. Hair down to her behind."
She laughed a bit and shook her head.
"Figured she was one of the summer people. Came to the store one day and so friendly. You know I don't like to get involved with that type. The ones who spend summers at the lake and have fancy leather pocketbooks. They change everything. You sound like Dad.
She shot me a parental look that said to me, he's your father. Don't talk about your father that way.
As long as I could remember, I'd get that look any time I brought up anything negative about Dad, like it was a reflex.
I knew Mom felt most of the same things I did about Dad from the your father thinks comments she would make about various things that bugged her, but she went along with anyway.
Your father thinks we should stop processing chickens for summer folks until they pay. I told them we can't treat them different than the others, but you know your father. Your father thinks I ought to keep the store open till after the fireworks in case someone wants a lemonade. That would mean 5 a.m. to midnight, but you know your father.
She kept coming every day. One day I had a cold, must have been mid-September. I was blowing my nose all over heck fire, and she said she had something would fix me right up. Ran out to her truck and came back with a bottle of cough syrup, it looked like. Helped herself to the kitchen and came back with a tablespoon. She said, two spoonfuls of this and you'll be good as new. It was purple and sweet. What is it? I asked. She said elderberry syrup. Explained she was an herbalist and that she could cure Ebola if she had to. Told me that the body knows how to heal itself and we just need the cures that are already in nature. You know me, Benny. I thought it was all a bunch of hooey. But darned if I didn't feel better the next day. And she came in that next day, and she didn't even ask. She knew I'd be better. We really became friends. When's the last time I had a friend?
The last part she asked herself, and I studied her, thinking the same thing. It was almost like I'd never thought of my mom as a real person. She had never seemed to need a friend. She had Dad, and while they didn't talk much, they didn't seem to need much either. He ran the fields and the business. She ran the store. If she needed a couple chickens, she'd tell him to process them. If a beef order came in, she'd say so. Words didn't log or hay or feed or milk.
Hazel would visit and we'd just gab away. One day your father came in and I introduced them. I don't know what I was thinking. Of course he thought she was weird. She is weird, Benny, I have to say. But I liked her. And she taught me so much about herbs. A couple times she took me to her place and showed me the tinctures she was making for this friend or that. Not a business, but she said she was thinking it could be. And I thought, what if we sold them at the store?
She was talking almost like I wasn't there, passionate in a way I'd never heard before from my mom.
I knew the answer. But also, it's not like the store is so busy that I couldn't try some burdock root and wild sarsaparilla. And I put some yellow dock root and vinegar in a bottle, and I left it for 6 weeks. And every day Hazel would tell me what it could do for people when it was ready. And I tell you, Benny, I got excited. I couldn't wait to try it. I knew what your father would say. Asked me was I crazy. Told me herbs was hippy-dippy stuff and did we want to lose all our customers? Folks don't like new stuff like that, he said. And Benny, I thought, some folks don't, some folks do. But I didn't say nothing, of course. So I did try the yellow dock root.
She smiled at the memory.
I harvested it in early December, cooked it up, and it tasted as bitter as tonic water and citrus peels combined. But darned if my stomach trouble didn't clear up just like that. Got a little more in the back. Don't tell your father. Just for me. Not selling it or nothing.
Wow, I said. So yesterday Dad said no selling? She clasped her hands in front of her. I asked, did he say you couldn't, like, see her anymore?
A glimmer of something overcame my mother's face. Regret? Her eyebrows twitched just a bit.
Just weren't worth the trouble, she said.
And as we sat there sipping cocoa, saying nothing, I wondered, if I had hypothermia, what did my mom have after all these years?
Did my mom ever say what she really thought to my dad, or was she always playing the role of the perfect wife? And then that thought felt a little close to home, so I stopped thinking about it. Before I left to go back to school on Sunday, I went and talked to my dad in the barn again. He was cleaning and refilling the water buckets.
"You got enough money for things you need? Books?" he asked, not looking my way.
"I'm fine," I said. "Hey, there is one thing. The baseball team, they're going to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. We're going. Spring break. The school is actually paying my way."
Dad frowned. "We don't need their help."
I shrugged but didn't say anything because actually we did. No way did we have $1,000 or whatever it would cost, and there was nowhere good this conversation could go if it became about my dad and his ability to provide for me.
"I know," I said, "but can I go?"
I knew I'd need to get his permission. The water got close to the top of the bucket, and he turned off the flow.
"Your grade's better now?"
I nodded.
"We'll see then. Keep 'em up and we'll figure it out."
I stood there, a tightness in my throat, my head buzzing a bit. There was so much more to say, about Mom, about us, everything. And I knew I would never say it. Chapter 18. The Wednesday after my visit home, Coach Donnelly turned over infield practice to me while he went to the other side of the gym to work with the outfielders. It was the first time I'd run any part of practice by myself, and my whole body felt jittery. The seven other guys milled around, waiting for me to get things started. I jumped in before my brain could tell me stuff about how I had no business acting as coach.
"Okay, gloves down," I said, my voice sounding deeper than normal, and I glanced over at Mendenhall, half expecting him to roll his eyes. He didn't. He just dropped his glove like everyone else.
"Pair up, and everyone grab a ball."
All the guys partnered up, leaving me with Clement, the freshman. I got everyone to do the drill Coach taught us, where we roll a ball to our partner, who ranges over, his glove hand on the floor, to field it before rolling it back. The right way to field is to stay low and move with the hop, in case the ball decides not to come up to you, so the drill got us comfortable remaining in fielding position.
"Do it like you mean it!" I yelled,
not to anyone in particular, trying to sound captain-like. I rolled a ball toward Clement. He seemed jarred by my yelling, and he fumbled the hop. I jogged over. His back was arched, but his legs were straight.
"Legs," I said. "Watch me."
I showed him the correct fielding position, and he imitated it.
"There you go," I said. "You'll find it easier now."
Clement said a quiet, "Thanks," and I jogged back to my spot. He did better on the next few rolls, and then I started to challenge him by rolling to his right and left, and he was up to the challenge and seemed to be really energized every time I said, "Attaboy." After about 20 minutes of various drills, I clapped my hands loudly and called everyone over. I'd seen previous captains do psych-up speeches, and they seemed to mean a lot to the other guys. They always left me cold. The guys circled up around me, and I jumped in.
"What's the goal this year?" I said. No one said much of anything, so I barked it again. "What's the goal?"
"Win," Mendenhall said, nodding.
"That's it. Let me hear you say it, guys. Come on."
"Win," the guys said, looking around at one another like they were surprised this was coming from me.
"Again." "Win. Again. Win."
I glanced over again, and Mendenhall was shouting just as loud as the rest of the guys.
"That's what I'm talking about," I said, sounding like another person entirely. "We're here to kick some ass, and I want you to put that kind of energy into everything we do, because it matters. Preparation is everything. Attitude is everything. Are we winners, or are we losers?"
"Winners!" they shouted.
I couldn't help but smile. We were winners.
"Now let's get back out there and do those drills again, the same in order, like twice as serious. Got me?"
"Yeah."
And I felt it in my head, this buzzing, wild sensation that came from being up to the challenge, that came from being the guy the team needed me to be.
Chapter 19. Rafe and I were studying in my room on Thursday night. I had a psych test the next day, as well as enough calculus concerns to keep my nose buried in a book for the next decade. Well, I was studying, and Rafe was kneeling at the foot of the second bed in the room, going through a pile of my books. There was something totally annoying about how Rafe took frequent breaks while I couldn't afford to do that, and also something totally Rafe about it, in a good way. He didn't get all intense about things like I did. I guess he didn't really need to. His family had plenty of money, so he'd be able to pay for college wherever he got in. Privilege.
"What the hell is the Museum of World War II?"
he asked, picking up a pamphlet that had gotten stuck in among my books.
"Are you struggling with context clues?"
I asked. He laughed.
"I mean, like, where is it and all that?"
"It's in Natick. Before I had a car down here, like back in 9th and 10th grades, I used to take the bus around to places. The Natick Historical Society or the World War II Museum. I was a member there, actually. Honorary. Came back a couple times, and they gave me a free member card." He sat down on the other bed, the one that used to be his. It was still a little weird to see him on it.
"Which gave you one free Luftwaffe for every 10 you bought?"
I laughed. "There's actually a fair amount of history in Natick. Harriet Beecher Stowe lived here for a while. Henry Wilson was from here. He was vice president under Ulysses S. Grant." He threw the pamphlet down onto the floor.
"You know so many facts. I think one of the differences between us is you are interested in things and I'm interested in people."
"Most historians agree that Ulysses S. Grant was, in fact, a person."
"I mean, like a person now. Someone we could meet and get to know."
"Yeah, I guess that's true. I'm not, in general, a huge fan of people."
"Present company excluded, I'm sure you mean."
I shrugged in an exaggerated way and he blew a raspberry at me. "So anyway, Wilson," I said, "he was a radical Republican and a staunch abolitionist."
"I guess Republican meant something else back then?"
Yeah.
"I guess I knew that. I wonder how a political party could change so much. It was like Democrats and Republicans switched teams."
"I'm not entirely sure."
"Are your folks Republicans?"
he asked. I shook my head. "We're staunch Democrats."
"I didn't know that. I figured they were super conservative."
"They are, Rafe. They're old-school Democrats, like the Southern Democrats who got Jimmy Carter elected. Socially conservative. At least, my dad is."
"Oh,"
Rafe said, and I knew he didn't know what I was talking about. "Yeah, my dad basically banished my uncle when he came out as bi, wouldn't accept him. My uncle went to China to teach English because he needed to get away from our family. He came back and pushed his way back in, but my dad never accepted him. My dad thinks my mother is hippy-dippy because she wants to sell herbal remedies at our farm store." Rafe whistled.
"That's... wow."
"Yeah, and I love my dad, but that's where I'm from."
"How is that possible? You're so smart and inquisitive and open-minded."
I shrugged. "I'm not my dad, I guess."
"I didn't mean that. I meant, no, I get it. I wonder that sometimes, too."
Rafe sprawled out on his stomach and opened his history book. He was studying the Russian Revolution, which I would have been happy to talk to him about if he wanted to, but he seemed utterly disinterested in doing anything beyond memorizing dates. His head snapped toward me.
"Oh, did I even tell you? I walked into my closet last night just before lights out, and Toby was standing in there. I was like,
he did that to me," I said, putting my calc book down. "My first night back. Tried to subliminalize me."
"That's what he was saying to me. Said he was going to help me with history using subliminal suggestions."
"He has so many issues," I said, and Rafe laughed. We studied, and neither of us spoke for maybe 30 minutes, at which time Rafe dramatically shut his book and sat up.
"We need to get Toby," he said.
"Must we?"
"I mean revenge, not fetch." As I said, must we? I think we need to subliminalize him.
Huh, I said. I closed my calculus book and looked at him.
You don't love the idea.
Well, I guess I just think, what will that do? If we're successful in not waking him up, we'll, what, spend all night in his closet talking softly?
He chuckled a little. I may not be the greatest prankster of all time.
We'll think on it, I said. Maybe we can make it better. Rafe nodded, and a few minutes later he stood up and went to the bathroom. While he was gone, I went into my closet where I kept my mini refrigerator and grabbed 2 orange Gatorades. No vodka this time. Ever since I got sick the last time I drank, I'd been off the stuff.
He came back and sat down on the other bed. I threw him a Gatorade.
Holy bright lights, Batman, he said, catching it.
Huh?
He pointed at my closet where I left the lights on.
Oh, that, I said.
I couldn't see my clothes, so I went and got a 75-watt LED bulb at Home Depot.
I admit it took me a while to get used to the glow, but there was something nice about it, especially in the winter when the natural light wasn't as plentiful.
It's so bright white. Is that where we go when we die? I think I see my dead relatives in there.
Har har.
NASA just called, Ben. They say the only things they can see from space are Las Vegas and your closet.
You get one more.
I think some douchebag just opened a Hard Rock Cafe by your button-down shirts.
Weak.
He kept chuckling to himself as he reopened his English textbook. I admit the jokes bothered me a little. I'd spend birthday money on the bulb. But they also kind of settled him back into the space a bit. And I was glad for that. We studied and talked and gabbed and worked until it was 1:30 in the morning, and then Rafe said,
So are you ready?
What?
Are you ready to get Toby back, I mean, for the subliminalizing?
Do I have a choice?
He shook his head no, and I shrugged. He explained that we were going to wait until Toby was asleep, sneak into his room, make a little noise to wake him up, and then jump out of his closet and scare the shit out of him. Normally, I would not do such a thing, especially because I didn't want to get into trouble. As the Pappas Award winner, I had to be careful. But it sounded tame enough, and if I did get into trouble, it would be with Coach Donnelly, who thought I walked on water. Anyway, I was dead tired of being the good kid. The killer of fun. I simply said yes.
Rafe suggested we both bring our cell phones so we could text each other while we waited, but I had to remind him my phone plan didn't include texting.
1997 wants its phone back, he said,
and I thought about explaining that whereas his birthday present was an iPhone, mine was a light bulb I bought myself. Instead, we brought a pad and a pen so we could write back and forth as humans once did, and Rafe brought his phone for the flashlight app. We cracked my door open and looked both ways. No light, no sound. I led us down the corridor all the way to the end to Toby's single room. He was sound asleep and snoring when we crept in. His window overlooked the other side of the dorm from mine, the street rather than the quad, and the streetlights illuminated his skinny face and now pink hair. We tiptoed to his closet, opened it in slow motion so as not to make a sound, and crept in and closed the door at the same speed. Toby's breathing never changed. He was still asleep and had no idea that he was about to find out what happens when you try to subliminalize the wrong people. We had not prepared, of course, for just how weird it would be in Toby's closet. Here is a partial inventory of what we found strewn about on the floor when Rafe turned on the flashlight app. Angel's wings, a half-eaten Hershey's white chocolate bar, a pair of roller skates, the right foot seemingly larger than the left by a good 2 sizes, a turquoise kimono with a floral pattern, condoms organized in 4 neat piles of exactly the same height, a bow and arrow, the quill of which was painted lavender, a pair of women's Spanx, a flyer for 2-for-1 pregnant yoga at the Natick Community Center. We looked at each other. Rafe opened his mouth to say something, but I thrust my finger in front of my lips and handed him the pad. He took it and scribbled,
"Do you think he's killed?"
"Oh, yes, definitely."
"Do you think he'll kill again?"
I grabbed the angel's wings and pantomimed devil's horns, and for some reason that made Rafe almost laugh out loud. We settled in, me sitting up with my knees against my chest and him leaning up against the far wall. His feet were inches from my butt, and I could feel the warmth of his skin radiating off his toes. There was a huge farting sound from the other side of the door, and then snores, loud. I put my fist over my mouth to stop myself from laughing, but Rafe wasn't quite as lucky. Giggles exploded past his lips, and I had to give him another look. He gathered himself, closed his eyes, and made sure he was composed. We waited. No sound. Constant snoring.
"Well, he's asleep,"
Rafe wrote. "Sounds that way."
"How long do we wait?"
I shrugged. I had no idea. I shifted my seat, rubbing up against a black overcoat. I hoped the noise couldn't be heard outside the closet.
"You're too literal, Albie,"
we heard Toby say in a conversational voice that sounded as if it were part of his dream, followed by some words I couldn't make out.
"He's out cold. Let's do this," I wrote.
"Okay."
We stood up, careful not to make any noise.
"I am the Muffin Man."
Toby's voice was like a monster's now, and Rafe and I, startled, grabbed each other. My heart was pulsing as I wished I'd brought a baseball bat or something. I'd heard about sleeping people who get woken up and do crazy things. What if Toby... And then I realized. I was staring into Rafe's eyes, my hands around his shoulders.
"I am the Muffin Man. I am the Muffin Man! Ah!"
He really sounded like a monster, and aside from the intense staring with Rafe jarring every part of me, heating up my skin from the inside, I wondered whether I might die in Toby's closet. Rafe pulled away from me and scribbled on the pad.
"On a scale of 1 to I may never sleep again, how scared are you?"
I motioned with my hand to show that I was closer to the extreme side of that scale.
"I did not kill that man. He deserved to die. Die, scum, die!"
There was a thump outside the door. I pulled Rafe close to protect him. The closet door opened.
"Really?"
Toby said, hands on his hips.
"Really? Truly?"
"Shit!" I exhaled and then realized I was still holding Rafe.
"Well, this part makes it all worth it," Toby said. "Thank fucking God."
I let go of Rafe and then realizing how Rafe might take that, I patted him on the back. He seemed entirely neutral to all this and I didn't know what to make of that.
"You mess with the king, you better kill him," Toby said, shaking his head.
"Don't you mean queen?" I said, and both Rafe and Toby looked shocked.
"Oh, no, he didn't," Toby said to Rafe.
"He did, though. He did," Rafe said back.
"So, all of that, all the talking in your sleep, including the thing about Albie? All a ruse. I heard you guys way before that."
"The farting thing, too?" I asked. Toby's face turned a shade darker than his hair.
Yeah,
he said, eyes averted.
"Yes, total ruse."
Chapter 20. We were nestled in my bed. I was pressed against her, spooning her soft maple syrup skin, the heat of our bodies combining into something a little like heaven. I ran my fingers against the nape of a long, feminine swan-like neck. I looked down at the smooth back, milky white. Rafe rotated his neck so I could see his profile. Not Hannah, Rafe.
"No," I said, but the words wouldn't sound as I said them. "Please, no."
"Yes," he said back, smiling.
Yes. Yes, I repeated, and warmth encapsulated my entire body. I whispered, "You're home," in his ear, and he giggled, and he said, "More like second base." And I laughed too, and I held him close, my chest pressing into his back, and I smiled. He smelled ever so lightly of vanilla. Then my eyes opened to reality, and I looked up at the ceiling, assailed by all the physical feelings running through my chest, my legs, my hips. My body was a maze of electrical impulses, and they were all lit. Rafe. Jesus. Rafe. I felt this guilty feeling twisting in my gut as I thought about Hannah, whom I really, really liked. I felt like I'd cheated on her in a way, even if it was just a dream. But I couldn't stop thinking about Rafe. I thought about the first time we kissed, out in Boulder over Thanksgiving, and how Rafe had exploded upon lip contact. And I thought in that moment, I can do this. This can happen. Then we slept apart, and as I tried to fall asleep, other more worldly thoughts had entered my brain. About my dad. About what I heard in the hallway when I was 12. What he said to my uncle, who had come over for the first time in 5 years.
Rejected you. You rejected us. We didn't move to China, you did.
I moved there because you and Dad said I was no longer family.
I don't know what you want from me. Only straight bones in this family. You're the one who's choosing men instead of women.
Men as well as women. And not choosing, this is who I am.
Talk normal. You want to be family? Be normal.
I heard that, and I knew what they were talking about, but I didn't. Like, all I really heard was the be normal part, and I made a pact with myself then and there to always be normal, no matter what. Or else I'd lose my family. So that night in Boulder, I stopped thinking, I can do this. This can happen. Because it couldn't. And anyway, I still thought about girls when I wanked, so I rolled over. How the hell had that dream happened? Is Rafe a wizard? The closet was intimate, I guess. It had brought back memories of that night back at Natick just after Thanksgiving, stuff I still didn't really know how to handle. I had been tossing and turning and writhing in bed. We weren't talking, and I was dying inside. And I needed him, but I couldn't have him because pride and fear had created a toxic jelly that floated in my bloodstream, stopping up my jaw, making it impossible to say words, any words, to him. Still, it was like I could taste him, and all I'd ever done was kiss him. But now I needed to know what the rest was like.
And then those footsteps. It was the cadence, a touch faster than walking and a step slower than running,
like he was yearning to be somewhere else, faster, sooner. If I had to guess, his cadence would be twice mine. I heard them, and I jumped up. I opened the door. The kiss happened right away, and it was wet and juicy and unbelievable. Our bodies pressed together felt different than it had felt with my first girlfriend, Cindy. Like hard against hard, with no soft relief. And that felt alien. I explored more because I could, I guess. I pressed my lips against his neck, and there it was, Rafe's skin. I flicked my tongue. He had an aftertaste like burning wood and chocolate, like the air around a campfire the morning after, where you know there's been a fire, but it's out now. I thought when I took him in my mouth that it would make me feel like a girl. It didn't. Truth be told, that part was less exciting to me than tasting the skin of his neck. I needed, wanted, maybe, to be near his face. When he used his mouth on me? Well, describing the way sex feels is like saying how steak tastes. It tastes good. It felt good. Great. But it still didn't surpass that first moment. The kiss, our heads connecting, and neither of us pulling away. I opened my eyes and looked at the ceiling again. That was then, this was now, and he didn't belong in my dreams anymore. Hannah was in my dreams, and she belonged there, and we were working towards something great. With Rafe, I was very okay with a close friendship, but beyond that, it got complicated. And my life did better simple.